Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Hello, this podcast is going to be about something called misfortune joy. It's actually got a German term for it called something like Schadenfreude. And now, I've learnt it several times. I couldn't actually, after a while, recall the exact pronunciation of it. So I'll talk about that for a while. Now, this you might call it, it's the joy of other people's misfortunes. And I sort of came to this by looking at a general envelope of, cruelty. Notice that a lot of people are cruel. I try to look at the motivation behind people's cruelty, and a lot of the motivation I've come up against, a lot of people tend to motivate, sort of analyse the effect of cruelty and how you overcome it, how you respond to it. I'm looking at the drivers of it, and I've come up reading about it, reading about this term, psychological term, about misfortune joy. This is where we get a kick out of knocking other people down for various reasons, and it's been analysed. Might be pop culture, something like that. But just go over it. That's if you imagine a layer of looking at what's going on. I would say I myself am subjected to a certain level of cruelty, and that's driven by something called misfortune joy. Then looking beneath that layer, I'm looking at people's... These don't quite go together, but people's use of induction or prediction for the future. So if you put the two together, you've got cruelty, and in order for that to go ahead, you need people to not have a very strong handle on reports and inductions, and you know, basically, in order to run the process, you've got to have classifications, and if someone is not of a particular classification, you've got to say, well, I've analysed it, and it's likely they will be of that classification. So there's that mechanism in it, and underneath that is the in order to push yourself into that sort of induction vortex, you've got to have this impression of analysis of people, a sort of unsympathetic analysis of people. So there are all these things to go across. And look, the basic thing is that this sounds enormously complicated. To just take one step, there's all these minute little, this leads to that, going forward. And in general, people have, over the top of that, a very low tolerance for complex analysis, trying to work out what's going on. They like it done and dusted. They want the fast food thinking. And I was just, had this sort of epiphany moment where I looked at software development for the development for the Einstein to Haas experiment. This is an experiment, a classroom experiment, which demonstrates quantum physics, and how I started off and broke the components down and eventually made progress. And similarly, looking back, I can see that I do make progress in these things, but it takes a very long time of sitting with a problem. That's problem stewardship, I think might be that. So what happened is that I'm making a little cube, which is the sort of next generation classroom Wi-Fi, all singing and dancing, connected, PLC controlled box, and it can do certain things like report all its readings once a second to the internet, and then be taken down. So, and it can do this. So the next version will have 6 temperature monitors. So you can have, say, for instance, you're looking at Newton's law of cooling. You can have what is it? 1 cup, a double foam cup, a triple foam cup, up to 6 foam cups, all filled with hot water, and then you put in the sensors, and then you can measure all this live. So you can imagine going much forward, or you can, with the sensors, you can do pressure and temperature in a box, and it's all there. All each sensor basically costs $5, and so if you herd them all together, the overall cost, additional cost of putting that sensor on the internet is really only about $2 each, and stuff like that. So this all comes in, but given a thermometer, a glass thermometer takes, costs, $3, and you break it so often. This one's obviously the way to go. But the point I wanted to make is that it takes... Oh, sorry, I'm just crossing the road here. It takes a lot of effort and time. And I was looking at the actual process of getting this information from the device onto the internet, from the internet onto the computer, and breaking it up. And each... I was looking at how I was doing it. And the graph... So it's been data logging about, 10 days ago, and it's every hour, every second, it's just beginning to pump out information, and I can see it there, and I was able to see how slowly and methodically I'm going, and going in a really complicated, hard route, which sort of maps my ability. That is, there's no point changing all variables at once, going way, way above your ability. You really got to build it to your ability and then slowly migrate everything. So what's taken a real heavy toll is being able to migrate it such that it handles the data as binary files rather than multi-text files, and handles it efficiently. So you can pull up a week's worth of data in a fraction of a second. And so the idea of this is that you type into your console a 3-letter code or 10-letter code, whatever it is, the name, and you go to the website, your computer program will automatically pull that off the website, and you don't do anything in between. It automatically does it. And well, it's hard to say. Now, it's going to be a hard sell for Australian schools, but I'm sure there are schools or places elsewhere which will take it. But the take-home story here is that faced with a bigger problem, slowly taking apart. And so I've got this big rehab problem, and slowly taking apart. I want to, rehab in a particular direction, and the powers that be don't want me to do it. And they don't want me to do it because they don't want me teaching. They basically don't want the analytical spotlight going around and broadcasting what's actually happening. However, once they've sort of realised that that's there, the last thing they want is someone who can read through their stuff and see how things are actually done. That sounds a bit sinister, but I assure you it's not. But what I'm saying is similar to this long thing, tracking the problem, having a solution, and that solution slowly goes forward. I've come up with this hierarchy to do with, misrepresentation of the candor of rehabilitation, which I'll talk about, inductive logic, and then the cruelty. And it's not going all the cruelty, and then this It's just something rather fun. This is the enjoyment of the misfortune of others, which is sort of pervading Australia and pervading education, pervading the system. It's this general, like a seeping of virus inside. Well, there you go. Talk about cockatoos. I'm just going to walk around these cockatoos and make them fly away and see if you can hear them. They're all silent. It's pretty interesting to see cockatoos. This is a... I'm walking home giving this, and there was about 30 of these big white birds, self-crested cockatoos. There's a guard one up the top watching you come across. they're a social group, so you can possibly hear them in the background. I've got to have very long to actually execute this. I'm sort of on the walk back from a blood test and all this type of crap. So let us begin in terms of if you see someone and they say, "Oh, I'm ill. Oh, I think I can get better. I really wonder how I do against the objective standards." You can actually look at that and say that's a hypochondriac. He's got unrealistic expectations of how he's going to get better, and he's being devious by not agreeing with us actually going to the doctors and stuff like that. However, this is not the case. You have a sort of a persona. Say if you're a professional persona, you're a firefighter, and you go to a house which is burning, and you apply the equipment to the flame, you might see the gauge is a bit dodgy, and you fix that up afterwards under the cover of the professional cover. So this is, the faults are not detected, obviously part of a professional thing, but they're under control, and the persona is everything's okay, or it's under control. Here, let's take charge. Now, that's one aspect. There's also the aspect of jockeying for dominance, which would be Fig Jam in Australian. It's Figjam. Fuck, I'm great. Just ask me. And it's sort of a way of projecting noise, sort of ego noise, to suppress other egos. You know, if you can talk around about yourself in the loudest possible voice for the longest possible time, by the end of the thing, the wallflowers who have got insight or who do have actually something to say don't get an edge in. The first thing is that to undergo rehabilitation, you have to be aware of some sort of deficit. But that is not to say you can an observable deficit. This is, you attempt something and it doesn't go quite well. It's like training. You don't necessarily have a complete model. You're not the sports coach or sports scientist. You don't know exactly what to do, but you can report that, look, the javelin hasn't gone this far. The shot went backwards and hit someone else. All this type of stuff. And other people can actually put the story together. And you can be in this training mode. So this candor of training and the candor of everything is not absolutely perfectly right. And you can be looking at something, but that can be sort of a side symptom. So like, say, your typing speed is not scratch, or all these various things are not a scratch. So there's the candor of rehabilitation, which can easily be misrepresented as someone malingering. And unfortunately, there's psychological tests, and you could say, "Oh, this person is not malingering." So malingering means putting on a fake illness for the benefit of some nefarious benefit. So there's that candor of thought. Then there's the irrational thought of cure, advancement. Now, this is different in terms of people in general go about their lives navigating from point A to point B and want to find the fastest route. Whereas in rehab, you're actually aiming over the horizon and you're not, rehabbing in such a way that there is a miracle cure, a miracle advance in the position, and your aim is over the horizon. It's unrealistic, it's irrational, and it is really could be said hoping for a miracle. Now, what has in actual fact happened is that when miracles do happen, when things unexpectedly happen, let's say like you get a sudden improvement or a sudden very obvious thing, like say a vision thing totally resolves itself, that's miraculous. And you go to say to people, look, this has happened, and there's this really weird thing that they say, they discount it. So it sort of really says to you, oh well, perhaps those people aren't the best in the rehab world, because they're judging, discounting, and doing things. This is sort of fairly objective thing. Something happened and changed, but to the outside person, you're conducting rehab aimed over the horizon, and of course, to an outside thing, this is madness. This person's, walking and attempting, and of course I can tell I'm not doing fantastically. So in one mindset, I just keep on going, get motivated, but then I have people just easily, effortlessly walk past me or effortlessly go up a hill or things like that. I can tell that, but it doesn't mean that the mindset is there. There's a sort of another layer, which I really don't have time to get on, but it's the idea of a knowledge broker objective test. And so you need it to aim for, but you also need it for people to sort of transactional tests. This is a test of exactly how well you're going and how well it is assessed by experts. There's one thing is you don't want to assess your own tests on as you go too hard. You need it for a sign, but that can't really be the guide, because that will get you going in circles doing not the complex things. And external people will say, bad test, good test, done. What's going on? That they won't sit there. So there's the rehab candor, irrational objectives, and measured assessment. That all goes into the rehab thing, which is separate from the professional demeanor. So you can get the often critique, valid critique, that in a professional level, the discussion of this sort of thing puts you out, and is no longer knowing how to understand it. Then we come across this thing of the type of logic used. Now, in medical professions, not medical research, but the practice of medicine, and the conduct of procedures, where the aim is to get conformal inputs. So you put an input, it doesn't conform, you analyse it, and then you feedback. There's a feedback mechanism. It can't really be disputed. And that's a deduction. So deduction is a way of thinking where you say A is evidence of something, and B is evidence of something else, and that therefore you work your way out to generate new information, which allows the information goes into the system, allows it to go forward. This is subtly different from research, where you attempt this full research where you're generating new knowledge or new system of thinking. There's also a projection forward that is going the same. It looks like research, but it's not quite research. It's from taking information and extrapolating into the future. That's from the past to the future. And this really relies, if you're not careful and you're used to doing deductive reasoning all the time, you often don't pick up some of some preconceptions, the basis of it all. That is I suppose what I'm really thinking of is the uniformity principle, which is past performance given a uniform experience means that we're going to have a future performance now of this. So I can, from this past, give a definitive statement about the future. And obviously this is going to be at loggerheads with the irrational future. It has some validity, but it has to have a certain undergo certain processes to be correct. So as you've got the candor of research, you've also got the candor of induction. And one of the things is you are making hypotheses based on evidence, and from a scientific point of view, there is the possibility of false positives. And all this false positives and false negatives, and the reasoning is exceptionally tricky because of little statements is, let's say, 2% of the people have cancer, and people with cancer have people who are 60 have got three times as likelihood of having cancer. You add all those things up, and you can actually, by your manipulation of information, you can actually get the wrong conclusion. It's a bit hard to describe. The way that you write probabilities down. So it may sound okay in English, but once you write it down mathematically, you can see this is not a valid thing. So, for instance, there might be this person can't do this in this situation, and I extrapolate it to that situation. That is all based on probabilities. But if you have a performance in a particular zone which talks against that probability, I don't say that all that well. What can I say? It's the entire sort of take-home message of Bayesian probability is that the probabilities you get are probabilities, you can't deny it. How good they are basically tells you how good your reasoning is. So you've got two aspects, two sort of horns to go in on the inductive logic. One is scenario analysis, that if the scenario happens, how does this actually affect the logic profile? So it's like your proposition is actually for the future is only a machine which you say, I press a button and it produces this result. Now, and it produces a range of results. If there's another result which doesn't go into it, what does it tell you? So your probability tells you about the quality of your prediction system. So years ago, I have a 50% right chance of being right about the rain. So, but as my computers and things go ahead, I can now predict a greater certainty. Now, if you get it wrong, you can feed that back into the system and adjust. So that's one aspect of it, but also this candor of actually including all data and even remote to the outside observer, remote the relevant data, and it makes it really hard reading for someone who's just unaccustomed to it. You know, you train that handling, but you've got remote possibilities which come into the fore if certain things happen. And of course, your model is not going to detect its sensitivity to error if it's poorly constructed. Yeah, what can I say? So you can say, your particular model, what happens if such and such results happen? What happens then? And if you say, oh, nothing, because it's done and dusted and it's going to produce this result regardless of the information, it's no longer a model, it's an instrument of it's an administrative instrument, which is a really important to see. So just in summary, you've got the candor of rehabilitation and the crossing of thoughts for it. Then you have then you have venturing into the future is objectively what's as a vehicle, as what you're doing, a vehicle to produce to the future, the right thing. How does that stack up against, you know, is it a horse and buggy, or is it a Ferrari, or is it an Abraham's battle tank? It's quite a big one. And I can look at it in a disinterested manner and actually look at it. And so this is one of the things that I have to say about this. Now, on top of all of this, if you look at the susceptible... Oh, one of the things I wanted to say with reports is that really there is a fundamental flaw in the process where the interest group can actually hire the consultant and make purchase a product from the consultant. Now, say you're wanting to build something, and you want an environmental plan, and that person and the consultant is, you've got two consultants, you've got a marketplace of consultants. One consultant knows that they overlook Aboriginal sites and they manipulate the data such that it goes across. Eventually you're going to have, as has happened, destruction of Aboriginal sites and loss of species. So in this case, you're eventually going to get discount people like myself, get them out of the system. However, there is actually a better... This is on the reports and adaptive logic. There is actually a better way of doing it. And this is where if you're a government agency and you want an independent report, you put that in to a report broker who looks at what you're saying and checks on the health of the people doing reports. Now, this may seem excessive, but it's a fairly simple process. If you know that you're giving a report and the person's going to look at the quality of your report, and so rather than people saying, this is a report I don't like, I'm going away from this. This is a report I don't like. Broker, you go to the broker, what's going on? And you say, well, these people don't know who's asking for it, and they also don't know whether this is a control report. So we give them these control cases to cover. So It seems very likely. This is the sort of gold standard of, I suppose, anti-corruption. And the big question is, why can't this happen here? So we're coming towards the end. The overarching thing is that if you look at a particular sequence of events, say trying to spike something or put someone off or destabilize someone like that, at the end of the day, a child looking at this will say, look, that is cruel. That is, this is a thing of creating discomfort and suffering. So you normally have cruelty to children, cruelty to animals. And so part of this, I began to look into this. If you look at step by step, it's cruelty, cruelty, cruelty. Now, of course, in this demeanour, you can't say cruel, that you were being cruel. You have the people going, oh, hang on, you're just making it hard for us. Of course, I don't want to make it hard for you. But associated with cruelty is a duty of care. So if someone loses control of their vehicle and drives into a childcare centre and, causes carnage, the difference is, say, if that person has an epileptic fit and the car's not worthy and it happens, that we would not call that cruel. However, if that person is able to exercise responsibility to do something differently, we would call that cruel. And this gets back to thing. So your immediate response, people's immediate response to cruelty, put your hand up for cruelty, are you asking for care? Or no, not really. The question is here, is the analytic question, so you can see analysis going at all these levels, is what would motivate things for cruelty? And I began researching this, and I wish I could remember the German word for it, but they basically said it's the joy of inflicting pain. So I would go further forward saying that there would be a natural duty of care, and I think if you want to enjoy something, you have to see your artwork. You have to have the artwork there for you to see. So I think all these things are in place, but the Wikipedia grade analysis is saying that there's three levels of this joy reward of seeing suffering. One is to a group, an authoritative, this German word, authority version of it. And this is where in a group, seeing this reinforces your membership of the group. And I really do think this is deeply ingrained in Australian society, because we were a penal colony. This idea of authority, putting people in authority and stuff like that, it's got a lot of currency for it. And so I'm coming home pretty quickly here. So there's that. There's the rivalry one, where you can actually you see something you want to compete against, and you have a direct benefit from seeing someone suffering, reinforces yourself. And there's a point in there that they say that this is really a low self-esteem problem. And of course, again, with your, this is a tall poppy syndrome, if they've got a self-esteem problem, they're wanting to actually activate the tall poppy, press the tall poppy button. And this is what's been said undercover about that. Then finally there's the justice one, that I've been hurt and I feel atonement by seeing you hurt. That doesn't make sense. However, I think this is a complex situation. You have the those three things actually work together in terms of you have people who are professionally jealous, sort of priming the situation. You have the authority figure doing it, but under the guise of legitimate causing of pain to go across. So this person, and they'll go out and they'll say, this is a justification for doing it. So they feel by summoning up a justification that actually sort of works against them, because if they put up the justification and it's false, it's a false justification for it. So we're looking at this, it's sort of like a software problem where the program isn't working, and you're looking at the formulation of the problem, which is the how you present or how you manipulate the data into the process. Then you're sort of looking, so you have to shape your data correctly to go in. So if you don't have the model of the candor of rehabilitation, the person's, you're not going to produce a good result anyway. Then you've got your computer program itself, the actual microscopic thing, where a computer program transforms data out, and it's computer programs are very deductive. They take the information out and spit it out, but they're not. Some computer programs can be diagnostic, and what you really need is a probability theory such that it's written in such a way that the probabilities can be interacted with. And if you have the system where it can't be, it's difficult to go across on it. And then there's the final thing of fit for market. What are we trying to achieve here? And I would say that it's a very profound thing. There is a cruelty agenda or joy of misfortune agenda underneath here. And I suppose really profoundly, you've got to work out, having assessed that, what your real objectives are. And it comes back to really the candor of rehabilitation. It is in this, given the go from A to B, there is things that you, by, I suppose, complete dedication, you can improve to the maximum possible point. And looking strategically, that is a strategic mindset. And looking at Clausewitz and strategy, the objective is to actually not rise above, but actually interact with the strategy as a body of consistent strategy, and look at where you want to go. Look at the centre of mass. So this, a lot of the centre of mass here is I don't know what it is, but the entire thing is that a lot of these things don't come easily, like the collection of data from this. It does come easy for me, because the problem is intrinsically difficult, and it's got another difficulty layer, is that you've got to actually mould the problem to your ability to solve it. And so here I'm approaching this, and I'm sort of trying to mould the problem to within the zone that I can actually solve it. So I've come up with these bases, and what will happen is that these thoughts will coalesce to really succinct actions, which are sort of, I suppose, designed for the centre of mass, and my objectives, which is basically maximum rehab possible, and to see if you can take down some strategic objectives along the way, like rebuilding and reshaping the way that we educate, because at the end of the day, it's not the way to go. Sorry if I'm fading in and out. I'm just trying to get to my thing. That's going, and that's thankfully 34 minutes, 39 minutes.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.